Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Like I said, I've been reading your book, and it's both really joyous and also kind of heartbreaking in some parts. Can you talk about what are some of the things that you're most proud of with your years in Motown, and also what some of your greatest frustrations were?
So now, is this my years in Motown or my years as a Supreme? Because it's kind of different.
Okay.
You know, I mean, there's several answers to that. First of all, I'll say in my career in terms of being one of the Supremes, we started singing in 1959. That's kind of like, what, almost 60 years, a couple years. Yeah. So, you know, for me, being a little black girl growing up in Detroit, Michigan, when segregation was still the thing of the land, I think that what I recall most of my career is that it was one of those things where we dared to dream and we made our dreams come true. And so for me, knowing that and having lived that, being here in America, this is the land of the free, the home of the brave. That's where I feel that we were able to accomplish what we wanted to accomplish. I don't know if we could have accomplished it in any other country. Right. I don't know that.
Right. You guys were really kind of at the forefront of breaking the idea of a black girl pop group. What was it like being part of that first movement?
Well, yeah, we the Supremes were one of the few. There were many girl groups out during that time, but we really were one of the ones who helped break through that mold in terms of 1964 when we became the first girl group to ever have five consecutive number ones. We were the first girl group to ever have, like, I think 11 or 12 gold million-selling records. It was an achievement that was probably magnified because black wasn't beautiful yet. So when that happened for us, it made me feel like what my parents had always taught us, you know, if you're a black person, when you walk out this door, you're the one who, you know, you're the one that everyone will look at because you're black, and you have got to make all of us proud. So I grew up with a mom, dad who, you know, couldn't read nor write, and for them, it wasn't a very wonderful world because they had to work hard. They were looked down as human beings. So when we the Supremes made it big, I felt that we had totally achieved not only our dreams, but our parents' dream of being, a good human being. And people could look up to us for once in the life of the black community.
You toured pretty extensively in the South in the pre-civil rights era. I would love to hear your thoughts about how far we've come as a nation and how far we still have to go.
Well, I think that we as a nation have come very far because, as I have always said, coming from the black community, you know, our great-grandparents and our grandparents were slaves. So now, yes, it's 2020 almost. All people are not still free, but yet still we are free in many ways that our parents didn't have an opportunity to be so. So I think that we actually have come a long ways. Obviously, still there's a lot of hatred out there. There's a lot of, just people not allowing other people to be free on this earth. We're all here. And I think that we've come so far in terms of now recognizing that. And maybe this generation can take care of it, where before the laws prohibited certain things to happen. But now we're changing those laws, and women are up there helping to change those laws. You know, there was a time when behind every great man, there was a great woman. Well, now that's not the slogan. It's alongside or sometimes even in front. We're running for president now. So I think that we have definitely come a long ways. Yes, we need to come farther. But things really don't happen overnight. We tend to think that they should, and they really should, but they still don't. So now that people are stepping forward, I think that's going to come faster because things are moving faster now than they ever moved before.
Right. So in your first tour that you did with the Supremes after Diana Ross left, you said in the book that you included in the set list a medley of country western songs about Texas. Do you remember what songs they were or why you decided to put that in the list?
I'm from Big D. We put it in because I think one of our first big engagements was in Dallas. And so our choreographer at the time thought it would be a wonderful idea. I think that was Jeffrey Holder of the Coca-Cola fame. And someone suggested, and we said, that sounds like fun. And it was an easy song to sing. So we learned it really fast. And as I mentioned, one of our first gigs after Diana had left was in Texas. So that's the reason why we put it in the show. And we had fun with it. I mean, it was totally fun, but yet still, because everywhere we would go in the world, we would try to incorporate things that were happening in wherever we were performing. So that was something we always did. And it was just fun to sing I'm from Big D.
Can you tell me, there's a beautiful maternity dress out there. Can you tell me the story behind that and when you wore that?
When I first started having my children, my daughter is 42 now. And I think, she was born in 1975. And so I was at a point in my life where I didn't want to stop performing. So what I did was when each time I would have a child, I would have one of the gowns copied in a maternity style so that I could end up working the entire time. I mean, I worked up until one time. I have three biological children. I worked one time all the way to up until my ninth month.
Wow.
Most time it was up to the eighth and a half, something like that, because I enjoyed being on stage and I was able to still look glamorous in my, sort of maternity gown. So one of us here at the LBJ's museum, and I'm very proud of that.
It's wonderful. In your book, you write very powerfully about how your bandmate and your friend, Florence Ballard, how a sexual assault early in her career just really kind of derailed her, and she had a really hard time getting back up on top. And you wrote that in 1986. Now with the Me Too movement going on, have you been thinking about that and how that impacted her?
It brings tears to my eyes whenever Florence's name is mentioned, and it brings tears because here's a human being, and I'm sure there's so many human beings out there who feel the same way. When you are abused, and especially as a child, you know, nowadays with the YouTube movement, people can talk about it. There was a time when you didn't talk about those kind of things. Now, if people can imagine how one of the Supremes who had been abused at a very, she was 14 years old. And she was a virgin, and so people were ashamed to say anything about it. So Florence had to suffer in private with that. Sorry. And so it was very, very hard.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, even in 1986, when you were writing about it, it still wasn't something that people talked about in the same way.
No, it still wasn't. And, you know, the sad part about it is that had Florence been able to get some sort of outside help, like today everyone says, well, I'm going to my therapist at 4 o'clock, you know.
Right.
Florence couldn't say that. So she suffered in private. And what happened was, I think it was Diana and I really felt that once we became famous, she would be able to get over it, because we, like everyone else, says once you're rich and you're famous, you know, you're happy. And that's not true.
Yeah.
It bubbles under there. And so for Florence, she suffered in silence, as I said, but also the money didn't help, the fame didn't help, and anything that went bad then would doubly affect her. If it affected me, you know, just the way I was, it really affected her. And so you react to that pain.
Right.
And then some people say, oh, you know, she's an alcoholic or he's a drug addict, da-da-da-da. But they don't understand the pain that makes people do that. You know, they do that to kind of hide the pain, to live, to survive.
Right.
So the YouTube movement for me is something that I'm very, very proud about, because I know it helps people.
Right.
And I know that it could have helped my friend Flo.
Right. On a much lighter note and a happier note, one of your songs is featured in this exhibit. Can you tell us a little bit? Stop in the Name of Love?
Oh, Stop in the Name of Love is probably the internationally known song of the Supremes, because everywhere I perform, women, men come up there and everyone knows the hand movement of stop. You know, it's like symbolic of the Supremes. So I think it's one of those great songs that Holland Doja Holland produced, our producers, and it's one of those great songs that everybody knows. It, you know, you can have all kind of hits, but there's always one or two that stand out, and that's the one, Stop in the Name of Love.
Is there any way you could sing a bar for us?
Stop in the name of love before you break my heart. Think it all over. That was my part. And see, I say that because Florence and I did all the oohs and the ahs and baby, baby, babies. And I said, but don't be saying anything about me, honey, because I was laughing all the way to the bank for 50-some years singing my oohs and my ahs.
Well, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.